Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
This podcast contains a content warning for a discussion of Lovecraft, racism, and horror tropes. I'm not keen on mincing words on this one. H.P. Lovecraft was a racist, and before you go making an argument for separating the art from the artist, let's be clear on another point. So are his stories. They encompass other problematic elements too, of course, misogyny, homophobia, right down to their core, right down to the very themes that recur throughout his works. You'll find the hateful perspective he had of the world, the ignorance of someone who viewed anything unlike himself with revulsion. While he drew inspiration from works predating him, what Lovecraft gave to the genre of cosmic horror was his hate, which is now video games' problem. For decades, video games have been regurgitating the themes, plots, and aesthetics of his stories with not one ounce of scrutiny. The half-breed monsters that embody the very essence of Lovecraft's revulsion, the troubled white male heroes that contain his arrogance and his gross simplification of mental illness, are recreated in video games with no subversion, no critical thinking. In doing so, they are breathing life again and again into Lovecraft's hate. At least Bloodborne had the decency to suggest that his protagonist could be the real villain of the story. That was from Sam Greer in a Eurogamer piece entitled Games Really Need to Fall Out of Love with Lovecraft. I'm Danielle Riendo, and this is Waypoint Radio, episode 199. Joining me today are Natalie Watson.
Hello.
Patrick Klepek.
Hello.
And Rob Zachney.
Hey, hey.
So today we're going to talk about Lovecraftian tropes in games, specifically tropes in games and not necessarily wider Lovecraftian sort of stories, just because this is what I think most of us have the most experience in. So things like cosmic horror, cultists, the idea of losing one's mind, Cthulhu, and the ways in which these keep showing up in games and why we still have so much of this influence in games when I think everyone knows that Lovecraft was such a virulent racist. And I am somewhat inspired to attack this topic today because I, like Patrick, and I think Rob as well, am playing Call of Cthulhu, the new game from Cyanide. And I am having the experience where I actually really love this game. I am having a wonderful time with this game. And I'm sort of wrestling with my own issues around Lovecraft while I'm playing it. It is it's something I would call it, this game, almost like catnip for me. It's very New England horror, as well as has all the sort of trappings of a B game, which I love. I love detective games. It's reminding me of Murdered Soul Suspect, which I think is one of the most underrated games of this entire generation. It's such a fun little sort of goofy New England-y ghost story. And this is just harking right back to a lot of that, right down to sort of janky stealth gameplay. And then otherwise, like, really fun stories and really fun sort of world building. So I guess I'm going to open up on that one. Patrick, I know you read a review this week of Call of Cthulhu where you kind of mentioned that this is, like, a bad game that is worth playing and interesting on a lot of levels, for sure.
Yeah, one thing I would push back a little bit on the notion that everyone is aware that Lovecraft is a racist. Like, I'm okay. Fairly new to... I didn't read a lot of Lovecraft.
Patrick got
up.
Shaken in chat 5 minutes ago.
Well,
we had to tell him about the cat.
That's big.
So that's what I think. A lot of people are familiar with Lovecraft on a osmosis level, in that Lovecraft has infiltrated all sorts of genre fiction. It is science fiction. It isn't specifically horror. It is all over the place. Like, Lovecraft is an unavoidable presence. The way I open my review of Call of Cthulhu is like that. This review taught me how to spell Cthulhu because it was sort of something that I could say, but I'd never actually written out to a point that I could do it without actually relying on a spelling correction.
Sure.
There were works growing up like the movie From Beyond and Reanimator, which like some of my favorite horror films that I didn't know were based on Lovecraft stories. I mean, I grew up sort of on Clive Barker and Stephen King, and I think there are a lot of people that, like, you say Cthulhu, they're like, oh yeah, I know, like the big squid monster. Maybe you say cosmic horror, and maybe this, but I just don't think a lot of people are actually that familiar with Lovecraft as a person, as a writer. I think folks like us maybe are a little familiar, but I don't think actually like the larger public who may even know who Lovecraft is by name and is aware of his tropes and his influence, not necessarily understanding like the sort of like large shift that has taken in understanding his work and what may have influenced sort of the whole theories behind some of the things that have proven very influential. So just a side note, I would point people towards, and I say the one that like informed a lot of my better understanding. It's called We Can't Ignore H.P. Lovecraft's White Supremacy by Wes House. It's at a publication called Literary Hub. It's really easy to find on Google. And we'll kind of walk you through step by step both the history and like the deep thematic understanding of why Lovecraft is fucked for a lot of reasons. Back to your original question on the game. Yeah, it's an interesting game because how it ties into this broader question of Lovecraft and the work is, you know, the art and the artist, blah, 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 blah. A lot of Lovecraftian-influenced video games just choose to not engage. They just sort of strip Lovecraft for larger themes and influences and kind of just proceed without engaging with the dialogue that has been happening around his work. And Call of Cthulhu does that. Like, this is not a game you should come to expecting it to be like a meta commentary on where people have landed on how to feel about Lovecraft or his work or create his work. This is a game that's like, yo, it's 2 a.m, you're kind of drunk, you're having like that one last beer, and like, what's on Sci-Fi? And like, what's on Sci-Fi is like a movie about tentacles. Is this good? Psh, nah. Is it like good enough? Like, hell yes. And that's really how I felt about Call of Cthulhu. Like, but I remember like struggling when Rob was doing an edit on my piece at the end. He like, I originally wrote this conclusion that was like so deeply caveated. It was just like me struggling with, okay, I just wrote, you know, 2000 words. This is a bad game. I don't know if you should play. I don't know if I would recommend you playing it. And I was like, I so heavily caveated it. And Rob was pushing me to be like, you enjoyed this experience. Like, you're allowed to convey that. You don't have to like set up that like this is bad and you're trying to forgive yourself for enjoying its badness.
Yeah, like I think and this is a part of myself I'm trying to get a lot more comfortable too. There are times where actually what you want is something that's only middling, only kind of good. Like this is the, remember Night in the Woods, the pizza scale? Yeah. It's described there, and like it's like you know, there's great pizza, and then in the middle there's this huge bar of like good as hell, and good as hell encompasses a lot, and I think sometimes you just want that good trash. Sometimes mm-hmm. you want a game that because the thing is, not everything can be Silent Hill 2. Not everything can be Alien, where you're just operating, like, you're in the hands of, like, master craftsmen, and you are, like, truly caught up in this, and it's almost torment. It's delicious torment. Sometimes you just want something that's like, look, we both know what I'm about to do. We both know the story that's going on here, and look, the execution, not gonna lie, it's gonna be fair at best.
Have you looked at my arm? I've got some buttons on it. Game, I want you to just fucking press them. I know what you're gonna press. Get up there. You're not even gonna press it that hard because you're not even capable of doing that. But just beep, 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 and we're okay. I am consenting to this middling relationship that we're going to have that I will forget about a week from now. But in this moment, it's fine.
There's that scene at the start of Cthulhu where, start of Call of Cthulhu where you're on the wharf and they're like, so where's this mansion? And they're like, oh, it's up there. And you turn around and it's a fucking like broken down mansion, no. Like sort of backlit against the sky. And there's a distant like lighthouse, like trying to burn through the fog. And like, it is the most generic dark and stormy night bullshit. Don't care. In that moment, I'm like, yeah, this is exactly what I am in the mood for in October of 2018. And maybe November still of 2018. But sometimes you just want that.
Yeah. And like I said, this game is like catnip for me, especially with the New England stuff, especially with the bad accents, especially with, like, I think this is a less competent Murdered Soul Suspect in a lot of ways, because I think that game is actually pretty competent.
That game is more ambition than this game does, right? So sure. I think like Murdered Soul Suspect, which is one of those games I've always wanted to get around to playing, but is the way you've always described it, the way I've heard other people describe it, is that it has ambitions that it falls short of. I don't know that Call of Cthulhu has particularly grand ambitions. And it's okay with that, and I'm okay with that.
That's a good distinction for sure. But there's something so comfortingly schlocky about, especially those first scenes, and with the accents. I wasn't fully prepared. I mean, Rob, you set it up with how bad the accents would be, but as a native New Englander who knows the various tinges of New England accent, I could tell a Boston from a Rhode Island, from a New Hampshire, from a Maine, from like an upper, like Bahaba, Maine kind of thing. Like I know, like I have the ear, and absolutely no one involved in this production has ever been to New England. I can't say that. I can't say that completely. I can say the accents, it's like words that end in R might have it and they might not. And then any other word does not. And there's more than the ah to the New England accent. I will just briefly say that. However, this is increasing my enjoyment like tenfold.
Yeah.
Like this is 100% one of those where like, oh, Jesus Christ, these accents. And I am cracking up and enjoying myself. The only time I've actually been scared while playing this game, and it's a creepy game, there's creepy shit going on, was when a guard glitched through a door the sort of like gotcha sound effect happened. And I had a jump scare, and I scared the shit out of my cat, who was, like, chilling next to me, screamed, she screamed, she jumped, it was a whole thing, and I was like, good job, game, you got one, even though you didn't mean to, you got me. It was, God, it was a beautiful moment. I guess one thing I wanted to discuss, aside from this kind of amazing game in itself, is sort of why these tropes are so popular in games. And it's obviously not just the Cthulhu game called Call of Cthulhu. Eldritch horror shows up all over the place. Things like cultists and madness and losing one's mind that shows up. Eternal Darkness is a good example of this. Bloodborne is a good example that we'll talk about a little bit more in depth, because a lot of folks have actually made the point that Bloodborne kind of does complicate some of this stuff on some level. There's a game called Eldritch that was really cool a few years ago that is, you know, 100% sort of taking off in this. And games that are not, you know, directly from this lineage, these are really, really common tropes in games. I think the madness trope is in itself, like, almost omnipresent in a lot of horror games. And I kind of wanted to talk about that. Like, what is it that makes these so popular in terms of, like, oh, this is something you can make a mechanic out of. This is something you can actually put in the systems of the game.
I think just to speak to perhaps the like the madness trope, I think that does something as a mechanic to reduce agency or to complicate agency for the player seems like a way of subverting the normal expectation. So I can see how that would be interesting. Also seeing, you know, things not behaving as you would expect them to, and enemies that were once a certain way, seeing their change in a way that is unpredictable or something like that. I think that sort of lends itself to a sort of breaking the not necessarily monotony, but the preparedness or the muscle memory that you get when you're doing it a lot, you know,
like
repetition,
your verbs in a game, like,
yeah, sure,
repetition.
It's not repetition, doing your reps? Something when you're in the habit of, that's what I was for, when you get in the habit and you have, like, you know, you're certain. This happened for me with Bloodborne when small spoiler for Bloodborne, but at one point in the game everything changes. So that's pretty vague.
Let's go ahead and stipulate we're going to spoil this turn in Bloodborne, because I don't think we can actually accurately discuss Bloodborne and its relationship with Lovecraft without, like...
That's true, because it is right now, the turn.
You don't skip ahead Bloodborne some spoilers. Number of minutes, but yeah, like, you can't really just... I want you to be able to talk about it freely, Natalie, because, like, even just the idea of the revealing of cosmic entities that are hiding in plain sight is a Lovecraftian trope.
Yeah. So, at one point in the game, after defeating the...
Rom, right? Spider?
Rom the spider? Yeah.
Rom the spider.
Which, like, destroys the veil or whatever.
Exactly. So, So, what's interesting is, throughout the whole game, the game kind of sets itself up as very... There is something dark and mysterious going on here, but it sets itself up to be... either like plague-like or disease-like, and there's a lot of talk of blood, and so you're kind of, your expectation is to, is that, you know, this is some sort of like transmitted parasite almost, or a virus or something like that. There's a lot of analogies to that. But you slowly come to understand that there is a university which is directly referencing sort of Lovecraftian tropes of pursuing knowledge and institutions that pursue knowledge and institutions that come across knowledge that they weren't meant to have come across. So when you get to Bergenworth, you jump in a lake. Well, you do a bunch of shit.
Yes.
You do a bunch of shit in the university. You see there's like these specific types of enemies whose heads are like super large, and they're like filled with brain knowledge. And when they attack
eyeballs
you.
Eyeballs.
Yeah. And when they attack you, they like try and suck from your brain. So there's a lot of like sort of pursuit of knowledge symbolism around Bergenworth. And then you get to the top, and you jump out this sort of landing that's at the top of the house or university or whatever, and you jump into a lake, and then there's a big spider with a million baby spiders, and then you fight that, and it's not really clear, like, okay, I'm fighting this. And for me, as someone who was like constantly fucking confused as to what was happening in Bloodborne, partly because of taking a week or 2 week breaks in between every time I played it, and also because I was so focused on just beating the game that I didn't really care what was happening, even though I should have. After you beat the spider, the world, when you get back to Yharnam, it's like what was cast in cloudy, a palette of cloudy grays is now cast in like oranges and purples, and everything is like super sunsetty, but like in a really like galaxy like sort of way, like super kind of cause like pictures you see of like the cosmos and things like that is reflected in the world itself. And all the enemies are kind of, you encounter new enemies that have like very space like or like tentacly, there's tentacles coming out of heads and things like that. And so, and a lot of them have these specific enemies that you come across look like normal people, and then tentacles will come out of their heads. So there's like still the sort of facade that they're the shell of like someone that once was, and yet they're being possessed, or that something inside them has been taken over.
You didn't do the DLC, did you?
I did not get there.
No, so that's interesting, because like in terms of the Lovecraftian connection, the DLC, the Old Hunters? The Old Hunters has a section that takes place in a fish harbor. And so like one of the big through lines in Lovecraft's work, especially the Cthulhu mythos, is, you know, like the connection to fish and crustaceans, and there's the tentacle stuff as well, related to, you know, things like octopus, but Bloodborne doesn't dip into that nearly as much. But when there is a specific section of the game in which you get a lot more of that, because it's then more directly related to sort of the conclusion of the story, and it inches a little bit closer to like way more explicitly Lovecraftian imagery.
Yeah. And I was thinking about Bloodborne in the context of critiquing Lovecraft, because there was an article that we read, or that I read.
Spinoff.
Yes. Piece. Yes. The spinoff piece. Here it is. Which you have right here, called Challenging the Bigotry of an Icon, How Bloodborne Slyly Calls Out H.P. Lovecraft by Dewey Lay. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Dewey Lay. And what's interesting to me is that I don't think Bloodborne ever treats its institute, or at least it never treats its institutions with like a blind trust in them. There's always sort of like a question of doubt, whether it's because of how mysterious they are, how vague they are. If you are confronted with them, there's not a lot of information given to you. And I think there's always sort of a motivation to question what's going on around you and who is participating in what around you, because there's not, first of all, there's no one you come into close contact with for a majority of the game. Like your direct interactions with people that are not your enemies are very rare, and a lot of the times those people change, and those people the next time you see them are your enemy and things like that. And so I think there's always a questioning of sort of who you are supposed to trust and who you are supposed to follow. And a lot of that game is self sort of navigated, I think. I don't think you, at least for me, I was looking to you and Austin most of the time for what the fuck do I do next? Or you look in the objects, you look in the materials, you look in, and people will kind of vaguely point you to different places, but there's no like quest marker. There's no like, it is very much like a self motivation that moves you through. So yeah, I wonder, what are your, yeah.
Yeah, I think the piece makes the case. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You
can finish it off. I think the piece does make a good case for complicating a lot of these tropes. Like, it is drenched in all of these tropes. It is reveling in these tropes. It is just getting drunk on them. Yeah. And having a good-ass time with body horror and cosmic horror. And there's some side quests you can do that are just, like, impregnation of a lady via wild, ridiculous cosmic horror alien stuff, and depending on the ending you want to get, Natalie, I'll try to be a little vague, I guess, but no, there's a lot of alien influence going on here. It's
kind of done, because my fucking save is on Austin's profile, so I can't even fucking play it anymore unless we're playing enough. It at work, so
you've defeated the cosmic horror by not going back to it. But it is but the piece does make the case that, like, it's playing with this stuff, it's having fun with this stuff, but it is never just sort of worshiping at its own altar. It is saying, this stuff is fucked up. Also, you're fucked up for doing it. There is sort of an indictment of the player character for even sort of going into this world and doing the things that you're doing. So it does, I think, make a good case for, like, you know, you can have your tropes and also critique them. You can have your tropes and not necessarily just sit there and love them and drink upon them. You can also critique them.
Yeah, it's kind of like, who are you to fucking participate in this? Like, right. Like the way that the characters in the beginning all sort of mock you and say, like, you think you are out here protecting, or you think you know what you're doing. And I feel like that is what we should be telling ourselves whenever we engage with Lovecraft, and whenever we engage with Lovecraftian tropes and concepts and ideas, because, like, we so often, and this goes for me too, because I had no idea who Lovecraft was, but I could tell you what Lovecraftian was for, like, the longest time until, like, probably this year, because I just never had an exposure to it, and I also didn't really engage with it so often that I was that curious into learning more about the history of it. I think what it's saying is that, you know, it isn't very often that we are consciously engaging with it, because we want to just take the monsters, we want to just take the cosmic horror and the ideas that are there, the visuals that are there, maybe the visuals that we've agreed to be good, because there are so many fucking visuals in just the week of research that I've been doing and that we've been doing for this specific podcast that are like so obviously racist. Like, he says it himself, and I don't know, you guys can perhaps speak to some of that we've uncovered this week.
Well, I wanted to definitely pivot over to Rob a bit, because I think of anyone, it sounds like you said you had a galaxy brain moment while deep into reading. Like, I think a lot of us have maybe experienced more Lovecraftian games. It sounds like this week, Rob, of the four of us, you spent the most time like in his work. So I'm just curious, like, you know, what was your galaxy brain moment? Was it three essays and two pieces into to yeah. Lovecraft?
No, it was. I was mostly joking, but I think there is something that Lovecraft taps into very successfully, which is that New England is kind of a spooky place, always has been. I mean, Ichabod Crane, all that stuff. Like, this goes back pretty far. But with Lovecraft, his writing has a specificity of vision that I think is important to look at. What Lovecraft is depicting in a lot of cases is this idea that there are forgotten places and corners in society that have sort of been left to rot and decline. And you have seen a lot of this in New England at this time, because like New England is full of towns that were really big during like the early stages of like the first Industrial Revolution. So a lot of like water-powered mill towns that crop up in like the 1840s, and like by the 1860s, 1870s, they're basically like dried up, like they've crashed, they've cratered, and so whatever prosperity they had, whatever boom they had, is already well in the past. And by the 1920s, a lot of these places are becoming like truly like dilapidated. And that is one of the things that he is writing a great deal about, which is this idea that, you know, even in the roaring 20s, even in times of like great prosperity and like technological progress, there are places in the world, but even more particularly, like, there are specific places and like corners in like the United States that, like, if you go down the wrong road and you stop in the wrong town, you'll come to places that are just deeply creepy and unsettling. And I think what's appealing about that is that it speaks to Lovecraft is pushing back against the myth of progress in a lot of ways. Like, he's speaking to anxieties and fears and concerns that are real. Like, I come from places with like lots of declined industry and such. And I think this is one of the things that helps his works endure, is that he is taking these familiar places and exoticizing them and making them like dark and sinister and spooky. And so I think it's kind of endlessly appealing to have these stories set in these border spaces between like the wilds of New England and the expanse of the Atlantic Ocean, and then also the detritus of like decline and decay and places where progress was effectively halted. Where this gets really sticky is that, so these are the tropes that are probably the easiest to decouple from Lovecraft's racism in a lot of ways, from his worldview. But even they're not really, because what he is describing in a lot of places is that, like, not only do places go bad, but the people in them go bad. And they go bad because of each other. Like, the place goes bad, but the people also start to go bad and they make it worse. And it's a vicious circle. And that is kind of Lovecraft's bread and butter, is that places can become morally degraded, and they, like, places don't just fall on hard times, but the people themselves become fallen. And I think it is very easy to indulge in that as well. Like, even if you're not depicting something that is like overtly racist, it's still very easy to take these tropes and make something that is overtly classist, that is overtly scientist.
Anti-rural?
Yeah, rural too, anti-rural, for sure. But more in the sense that, the rural is the place that, the pagans used to live, the heathens used to live there. And so, the ancient knowledge from, in Lovecraft's view, people who don't even count as, full humans, right? Those are some of the things he's playing around with. And so, I think it's tough to get that hit of what is fun and spooky and cool about Lovecraft, the gloomy forests with rain dripping through the leaves and all his writing. It is ponderous as hell. He is a ponderous writer, but it is very descriptive. It is very lurid and heavy-handed, but it's also very easy to take some of that stuff for inspiration and end up making something that fundamentally is echoing Lovecraft's worldview, which is that, again, people and places go bad together. That if there is a part of modern American society that gets forgotten and falls into hard times, that isn't because of anything that's fucked up about that society. That's because there's something fucked up about the people who live there.
And there's always an other, right?
Right.
The other is always a huge part about his work. Is it's the dimensional aspects, the othering. There's always an explanation. There's always a reason that is not incumbent on you. There is an other, whether it is a cosmic being or whatever, that is responsible for the decay, the destruction, the ruining. And you can see how you can that why his thematic work survives through the decades, because the notion of othering as an explanation for the destruction of the status quo is an eternal, theme. So that stuff makes a lot of sense. But once you start deconstructing, once you look at his worldview and then you see the way he uses othering as a means of explaining rotten decay and a form of conservatism and against change, it's his work goes from explicitly racist to being more classist, that brings in elements of racism. But again, he's not just racist. He was racist for the time, right?
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of hand waving we can do in which it's the time people existed in. But he was seen as a extreme even for his era. When Rob jokes about reading what his cat was named, go Google what his cat was named. We can't say it on this podcast. Some of the poems he wrote about the origins of black people, go read that poem. Some of that stuff is it's genuinely, because I think when we think of he was racist, you can kind of gin up in your mind maybe what that means. But it's
if
way
it's symbolic and
right.
And you
it's
know
like, oh he just
and,
didn't
and
like black people. It's like no,
abstracted.
Like this was a man that spent a lot of fucking time thinking about the ways black people, Spanish people,
Jews.
Across, just immigrants in general, people who,
yeah.
Non-white, he was a master race person. He wrote, I just got to read this goddamn, and I will get to you, Natalie, just a second. I'm sorry, I did not mean to hijack your point, let's see, this is from the essay I had quoted earlier. In this case, Lovecraft, his sympathies with rising fascism were equally transparent. Quote, Hitler's vision is romantic and immature, he stated after Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. I know he's a clown, but God, I like the boy. I just mean to underscore there's racism, and then holy shit, there is Lovecraft. And he was beyond the pale at the time that he existed, once you see the lines like that, once you say the explicit ways he talks about the dehumanization and the villainization of black people, it's so hard to decouple that from the way he uses themes like otherism in his work. So,
yeah.
Natalie.
I was just kind of chirping into what you were saying about, I think a lot of the time it is easier to condone, or maybe not to condone, but to wave away racism in literature that is masked by symbolism, or that is masked by, because we can we can conceive that there's something else to put in that other, that we can conceive that that we can say classism or that we can say something else. But that classism is deeply rooted, the classism of H.P. Lovecraft is deeply rooted, and I'm no fucking expert, so I'm just putting that out there, but is deeply rooted in the immigrants, and so that are like entering these New England spaces. And so when Rob, you're talking about sort of this exoticizing, it is coupled with an exotic peoples, that an exoticizing of the space itself, the environment, it seems to me to be also coupled with the exoticizing of the peoples coming in or becoming present, becoming known here. But to see H.P. Lovecraft be so unabashedly unrelenting in his just absolute disdain for anyone non-Aryan.
Basically, yeah, that is the right phrasing of that, like non-Aryan. Like, he's proud of it. Like, he's proud of it in a way that is like... Some people masked it. Like, Lovecraft did not mask it.
Absolutely not.
But his work masks it. And so it's like, you only engage with his work, and you don't know about the history. It's easy to see why all sorts of people fall in love with just the themes without understanding what those themes were built upon or might be saying.
Right. And I want to challenge that, because I think it is not so hard to see the racist foundations behind the idea of the monster that Lovecraft propagates, and that it is an unknown, an other, a shadowy figure. Like, it is not that hard to make that jump. And so to ignore it and to not think critically of it, I think is being a little careless in your consumption of the tropes themselves. Especially when looking at like hybrid monsters, when looking at monsters that are half human, half tentacle, you know, when he talks about sort of the change and the metamorphosis and the combining, like that is so obviously talking about, people of mixed race and of different races, you know, copulating together and having generations of mixed races or whatever. It is so obvious to me, and maybe it's obvious to me because I, being half Latina, having, like, reading this, it is obvious that there is that behind it. Like, it is impossible for me to ignore, because I see it in, I can see it in plain writing, and I can see it in the symbolism. So I don't know. I have a hard time just sort of even accepting the most symbolic of Lovecraft's ideas.
Well, and like it's actually pretty hard. Like, Patrick, like, if you start reading these things a little more, like, it's so front and center. Even in, so, Dunwich Horror is an interesting one, because this is one that's like, there's no outward racial component to it. Like, it's described as a town that's sort of like time forgotten. It's an old waspy northern like Massachusetts town, but he's like, but they became degraded and declined in there, like, and it's all bullshit. But the way he describes that is like really specific about the way their like facial features are changing, like, you know, skull like, it's fucking like, he, the minute he's like, how do I show this town is going to hell in a handbasket, like, he is rushing out there with the phrenology calipers being like, well, let me tell you about how degraded these people have become. And so it, like, it's amazing to me that this stuff is maybe not better known, but I guess not, because here's the other thing, though. I think so much of this is consumed secondhand or thirdhand.
Yeah. That's what I mean. I think that's the influence true. Of Lovecraft is most of people's consumption of Lovecraft. It is very rarely, like, there are not major theatrical adaptations in the last 20 years of Lovecraft's work. The closest was Guillermo del Toro trying to do At the Mountains of Madness. It didn't happen. But, like, his his work is everywhere. It's just right. It's secondhand, in which those creatives have stripped away a lot of that stuff and are largely just leveraging the aesthetic, right? It's just leveraging the aesthetic of Lovecraft. It's why Cthulhu is, you know, and you know, sort of like crustacean fish imagery is prevalent, or like, you know, cosmic horror in general. But like, it's all secondhand. Like the From Beyond, like the adaptation is an 80s B movie. It's not like a serious engagement with his work. And so,
which
yeah,
should
I think
say
you're,
something,
I think you're right,
Rob.
Yeah.
Right?
It does. Yeah.
Like, why aren't we quoting Lovecraft himself when we talk about Lovecraftian shit? We're quoting other things. We're quoting other books or other movies or other games that use his shit. So why, like, it that should be a red flag in of itself. And
well, how much of that is because Lovecraft, one thing he did do was he created, we call it the Cthulhu mythos or whatever, but he, like, more than that, he created kind of a fictional universe. And if there is one thing that, you know, modern media, but particularly games of every stripe, love, it is a world with tons of world building that's already been done and tons of settings and interconnected bullshit you can pull in. And so, like, yeah, you could make a, you know, horror, you could make a horror themed board game. You may, and there are, there's plenty of them. But, like, one reason that Arkham Horror became so popular is because it pulls in all this shit. Like, it is a game that is referencing all these different stories and all these monsters that Lovecraft sort of ties together and creates in this larger, like, almost Tolkien-esque world of, like, monsters and madness and elder gods. And I think that is one reason for its enduring popularity, is because, like, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is just the one book. It's the one story. But there's not, like, for, like,
a universe. Yeah.
They tried, right? The Dark Universe. They're,
there's,
like,
no MCU. Yeah.
They were like, well, we can somehow tie together all these random.
They opened The Mummy with a Dark Universe logo.
Yep.
Have to watch that movie. It is astounding.
So that is that shit fucking craters, because these things do stand alone. They're self-contained works. You can't, like, go in there. There's no Silmarillion that Mary Shelley wrote to be like, so here's, let me tell you about where Dr. Frankenstein went to school and his crazy teacher. Like, you don't get that. But Lovecraft is there with just, like, an endless buffet of settings and sources and references, and that is hard to pass up.
Well, there are two things that are interesting. When I was reading through, like, his biography, one, his work is largely in the public domain. So, like, that's a huge, like, component of, like, that stuff kind of slithering its way into different places. Two, he was sort of an early, like, he encouraged other writers to incorporate references to his work, to take, you know, things like Cthulhu. Like, he wanted his work to be in other things that weren't, like, collaborations. He just wanted to see his work referenced elsewhere. So, like,
he was a good marketer.
You know, I did, this is, you know, blind, you know, again, like, in my piece, I spoke to my blind ignorance on the sort of influence of Lovecraft on things that I was consuming that I didn't even realize were Lovecraftian. I did not know the Necronomicon was Lovecraft. I just didn't know. Like, I knew it wasn't invented in The Evil Dead, but I didn't know where it came from. I just never did the research on it. I had no fucking clue that was him until this week. I think stuff like that speaks to, like, he as an author knew that it was worthwhile to have his work referenced, and that, like, the fact that it went to the public domain mostly through, like, a loop of, like, his will was fucked up. Like, that was not his intention at the end, was for that to just go all public domain. But I think you can see some through lines there between, like, encouraging authors to reference his work becoming public domain. And then that way, like, it just exists, like, weirdly in, like, sort of this other dimension where it's being plucked from without explicitly referenced, in a way that some people are doing, you know, knowingly. And I think there are, in a lot of ways, it's being used in a culture unknowingly, without people understanding, like, the full consequences of taking from it.
That in America is racist. Like, yeah. A lot of these things are resonating on a level where maybe people aren't actively saying, like, I hate X, Y, or Z, but it's resonating with white, you know, with white people. It resonated with white people 100 years ago when he was writing this stuff. Like, it's very of a piece, I think, with Puritanism and conservatism. And frankly, New England is a very weird place that, you know, Rob, you were talking about this a little bit in its sort of physical attributes, but socially, New England is a place where indigenous people lived, and then here come a bunch of basically white hyper-conservatives. These were Puritans who came over from, you know, from England, and they took over and did all this other stuff. This is a very, very, very Puritan place. It was a Puritan land that then became sort of industrialist. And you see this in the whaling as well, which is actually directly referenced in the game as well. Like, whaling towns were often some of the greatest and most, like, moneyed whaling towns were deeply Quaker, the most religious people, the most utterly, you know, God-fearing, stiff upper lip, blue-blooded New Englanders who were getting rich off of whaling were so very religious and so very conservative. And the incredibly bloody and truly horrifying practice of whaling, which, if you know anything about it, it's really, it's some grim horror movie type shit. It was a major industry in New England for many, many years. It was like big ass moneymaker in a lot of these places. So a lot of this stuff is stirring in the sort of public consciousness of this place, of these six weird, odd little states that all have their own state governments, even though the entire place is only the size of, what, like a quarter of California, something like that. It's really a truly profoundly weird place and a profoundly racist place, like the rest of America. And I think there is some of that happening on that symbolic level where it's like, no, it's just resonating with the racism that kind of we all have in America, that we kind of always did have in America, that was maybe even more front and center at certain points in history, but is absolutely still there. So that's a part of this that I have a really hard time with sort of confronting on my own as I'm like enjoying this game and laughing at this game and laughing at these accents and having this time of my fucking life and sitting here kind of like, it's not even just Lovecraft himself, the virulent racist. It's also the Lovecraftian tropes that are racist. And it's also the sort of New Englandness that I grew up steeped in, even though I grew up in the 80s and 90s. It's still there. It's still permeating the air. It's still in all the brick buildings and so on and so forth, for sure. So that's a point, I guess. That's a grim and sad and somewhat resonant point, I suppose, to bring up and bring to bear here.
I mean, I this is one of the things I was wrestling with when, you know, I guess when we, it sounds like something you're wrestling with too, Danielle, is like, okay, so what does it mean then to also, to all those qualifiers? We've had this big conversation about Lovecraft, and it's like, all right, I still, like, mostly enjoyed my time with that game. And it's like, well, what do we do with that? Like, how do you either justify that? How do you qualify that? How do you, like, sit with that? You know, I mean, you know, I think the very basis in my mind is to, like, be educated on that stuff, like know the work that you are engaging with, like to more readily identify and understand, like, how it's being used. I think that's, like, a really, once you have the, like, if you didn't know what Lovecraft's work was based on or what his worldview was, well, once you know, it should be on you to engage with that and try and learn what you can so that when you're engaging with work that is either specifically his or on the periphery of his or influenced by him, that you can go in with that knowledge. And then, you know, so I, you know, maybe it's not great, but I found myself feeling okay with playing through that game. I'm not sure if everyone will fall that same way, but I found myself okay with separating those two things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be easier to make that separation when it is presented without, like, if you just see the image of the tentacle monster or you're just in the New England setting, where I think it's because those or the
Necronomicon.
Necronomicon. Like, those are just being placed, like you said before, like the aesthetic is just being presented without any, exactly, without, like, as a reference, without any sort of context or without any sort of treatment. And so I think when that treatment is given, it is important to first of all, I think they should be treated in the first place. And then
right, yeah.
When that treatment is given, I think it's important to be conscious of, you know, okay, is the game saying something about, you know, when you see mutations happen, when you see sort of like the in-between, when an other is introduced, like who is being imagined as this other? Like, I think it is really important not to be careless as a developer with the pool of tropes that you're pulling from, and also as the player to be conscious of, okay, as I am participating in this, what is my play saying here? Like, what is my play saying as I move through this world that comes from this person?
Right.
So I would just encourage people to ask those questions, to see how being informed of the person himself changes the way that you find these experiences to happen.
Well, just when a reference is dropped, you have a better context of like how the reference is being used, and I think that's like useful, like regardless of how the product itself or the art itself is deploying it, right? So it's like Call of Cthulhu is a very functional, referential use of Lovecraft and the Cthulhu sort of arc. It's not trying to do anything deeper, but that doesn't. Yeah. It is worth understanding because there are ways that like that game could be using it in explicitly or I guess more implicitly racist ways that it's not even aware of, because maybe the people putting it together weren't aware of how they were deploying it. And so it's useful for you to at least have the knowledge of, like, so you can recognize that and like call it for what it is, even if what you're coming to the work for is like, I just want spooky tentacle monsters, and like, I'm cool with that. And like that is okay. But it is worth having that full knowledge so that you know the consequences of the work that you're engaging with to for as much as you can do.
It is okay. But again, I'll just reiterate that it is harder to ignore when you are the one being critiqued in that aesthetic.
Yeah, like, no, fair. 100%.
Being like being specifically mixed race, like being a person of color, being Jewish, being any of the things that fucking H.P. Lovecraft thought
anything
were disgusting.
Other than a white person.
White wasp.
Then specifically an Aryan. Yeah, specifically
wasp.
Aryan.
Yeah. Wasn't into Catholics either, this guy.
Yeah, so it just, and like extreme heads up, the stuff I read was so deeply upsetting of his writing that is like more explicit. And so, yeah, I just, it is hard to ignore, but being conscious of it, it kind of makes me feel like I have sort of like a almost an added layer of security and like self protection when I like go into these spaces or like go into these games, because I feel like, okay, I know what the fuck is going on. Like, you're not going to pull one out on me. Like, I'm navigating this space with a consciousness, with an awareness, and I feel that I can be sharper and more cognizant of what's around me. So
you
I think
call
that,
call bullshit for bullshit when you see it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And this is one of those discussions where it's like, I think the stronger choice is to say, fuck you, Lovecraft. And the stronger choice is to say, hey, fuck these tropes.
If you're going to use them, subvert them, right?
Right. Like, if you're going to use them, subvert them. Be smart about it. Be smart about how you're approaching this. Be at least give me some subversion. Give me some sign of life that is, you know, kind of going on under the surface there. Give me some sign of that. Like, it's so complicated to wrestle with some of this in terms of like, oh, enjoying the game on its merits, even if the game itself is not technically the most impressive thing in the universe. And also, being upset about these things and aware of these things and not wanting to give myself the excuse, not wanting to, you know, get off the hook and be like, well, this is fine. I mean, like, I, the cemetery where Lovecraft is buried is a block away from the house I grew up in. And people would actually come around, like, in Halloween. Like, nerdy white boys would come around and be like, where's Swan Point Cemetery? And it would be, like, a thing. This is, like, a thing forever in my life that I've always sort of been like, maybe you shouldn't go there. Maybe you just go read something else, dude.
Maybe they're going to spit on his grave. I don't know.
I mean, that's possible. That's possible. That is true. That's a good point.
It's like, it is what Rob says at the end of every Waypoints. Do not give in to astonishment.
Yes.
Dang. Wow. Right? Thematic overlap. Yes. Natalie Watson, I am impressed.
Don't accept, and it is what we talked about in Red Dead Redemption today. Like, don't accept the spectacle for what it is. Like, don't be so super, like, you are deeper than that. You can think more deeply than that. Everyone can think more deeply than that. The spectacle is dazzling, it's beautiful, it's entertaining, it's enjoyable. But when there are real world implications all around you, it is important to also have the second thought. Like, you can have the first thought. You can be like, hey, this is really fun. I had that, like, during the Purge series where I watched certain scenes and I was like, hey, this is a really fun scene. And as I'm talking, I'm like, actually, this fucking sucks.
In real time when we talked about the final
in the
sequence
first
of the
episode.
First movie. Where you were like, yo, that was super fucking satisfying. And then we played the clip and I was like,
Exactly. I was like, actually, I fucking take that back immediately. Because that scene fucking sucked.
Well, that's because that's where what you were saying, the idea of, like, the first time you watch it was the spectacle, right?
Yeah,
where it's the
exactly.
Catharsis, where it's like,
where it's just
fucking, she hit that woman and it felt good. And then the second time you watch it, it was like, oh, wait. It's like, more closely examine what this scene means. And that's exactly what you're saying. It's like, allow yourself to have, you can have that enjoyment, but then, like, interrogate your reaction and how you felt that way. And I think, and that's also like, I think Call of Cthulhu as a game is disappointing in its cowardice over engaging with, like, Lovecraft as a person and the implication of his work, because I think there are way, like, I think at this point, if you're going to invoke him, and especially if you're going to invoke, it's not just referential, it's not just, like, influenced by, it is taking of his work wholesale. It is then cowardice to not engage with that, to critique it, to incorporate him and what his worldview is. And that's why I'm super curious about, like, The Sunken City, the next thing coming out. Like, is this also going to be one that, like, avoids that?
Huh? A lot of fish people in that one. I'm nervous.
Right. Whereas, like, as I mentioned in the review, like, HBO is doing this show in collaboration with Jordan Peele. He's a producer on it. He's not, like, writing or directing it, but which is called Lovecraft Country, in which it's a road trip movie during the Jim Crow era. And it's like, all right, so this is a show that is going to say, fuck, if we're going to do Lovecraft, like, we're going to do Lovecraft in, like, a more modern lens. And so I don't know how that show will be. I don't know if it'll be any good. But it's like, that seems like a more thoughtful alternative way, like, in 2018, think about Lovecraft is like, okay, like, if you're gonna do it, like, you should do it. And the idea of not acknowledging, you know, the critique of his work, like I said, is a form of cowardice. And actually, you could maybe find something interesting if you start weaving that into the work itself.
Yeah. Awesome. I think we need to take a quick break. I've let things go too long. We've just been so passionately in discussion about these topics. There's probably going to be an ad here. I'm not sure.
Who can say?
You're not sure.
Who's to say?
Who knows, really? So we'll be right back with a few last points and then the quickest little dip into the question bucket. So we'll be right back.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Wow, that was an ad. Probably.
Or not.
Maybe. Who knows?
Who knows?
Rob, I know you wanted to respond to some of that.
Yeah, I have complicated feelings about this, because sometimes...
Talk to me, Rob.
Will do, Natalie. look, sometimes I just want my fucking theme park. I just want it dressed up in this fucking costume, and I want people to be like, don't go up to the old whatever place. The dark things happened there. Ya townie? Or something like that. I don't know. Like sometimes...
Ya shyster!
Yeah, you shyster. Like, sometimes I want that. Sometimes sometimes I want a place that is just evocative of the smell of the tidewaters of New England and just the, like, pervasive gloom of the region. And I don't need that work to be freighted with a ton of reflection on its origins. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I do not need Call of Cthulhu. I really do not need Call of Cthulhu to be the game that's like, you know, it's critical that this game start unpacking its own origins and historical context. Like,
I also don't want to see that game try to do it, honestly.
No. But so, like, I think, and that might be, and the thing is, that might be an incredibly lazy and self-serving response. It might be. But I think right. There's also something to be said for not every piece of media needs to or should or is equipped to be that critical work, to be that interrogating work. I think that is on you as an audience member. But the other thing that I'm sort of wrestling with here is, but why do I like the tropes in the first place? And this is the other part of it.
Yeah.
It is worth reflecting, not even more so than maybe on the works themselves that you enjoy, but why do you enjoy them? Like, what is being serviced here? Like, why is it for me that I find stigmas against people, like stigmas against like mental health issues are terrible and offensive? And yet, if there is like a piece of media that's like set in just the worst eras of understanding and treating those issues, right? Like, like trope I find creepy and scary and largely successful for me is like the old 19th century, you know, insane asylum, right? The white coats, the cruelty, the barbarism of it. I find that incredibly effective. I'm not saying I seek out media like that, but when that stuff is deployed, I tend to be like, "Ooh, that's scary. That really got me. This is creepy." And at that point, I need to think about why that is. Like, that's the thing. I like that reaction is the thing that I become more concerned about. Right? Like, okay, like, what, like, what level is that hitting you on? Is it hitting you on the level of you can sympathize with the person who is thrust into that situation and mistreated and abused under the guise of, like, perverted and twisted, like, science? Or is it that on some level you have still some sort of outdated, like, subconscious response to these issues that makes the horror of the 19th century madhouse more effective to you? And that's the other thing that when I look at media with these sort of complicated origins and the trades in these kinds of problematic tropes, these things persist for a reason. And a lot of times there's parts of them that I will allow myself to enjoy. And the thing that I find myself increasingly like thoughtful about or concerned about or reflecting on is why does that story speak to me? And I don't know, man, like that's some deep level stuff. Like that like you can introspect, but like, do you get answers about who you are and like what is driving you? It's tough. It takes a long time, but those questions are something I find myself increasingly returning to.
No, but at least you're asking the questions.
Yeah.
And I do think
is it like Rob's point though that like it's easy to say, I'm asking these questions about myself, but I'm also going to keep enjoying that thing, right? Like, so it's like, that's like the thing you're wrestling with is like, it's, even if you're asking yourself, why are you enjoying it? It's also then easy to use that as an excuse to then allow yourself to keep enjoying it.
But I do think it's also like, but I think if you start wondering if the answer is going to be a bad one, you know what I mean? If like, oh, what I enjoy here, when you start realizing like, oh, the enjoyment of my enjoyment of this is because on some level I enjoy stories that trade on the fears and dreads of an early 20th century race scientist. Like, when you realize that, like, oh, shit, I'm enjoying the shit out of this thing that fundamentally is saying that the other is creepy and deformed and bad and must be, like, when you start to realize, like, if you sort of start having those realizations, it's time to, like, pull the fuck out. Because the enjoyment itself is going to be deeply, deeply poisoned. That becomes something you've kind of got to sort of reflect on and expunge from yourself because, like, that's the poisonous part. And I think that's the stuff that worries me about the ongoing deployment of tropes like this, is that at best, I'm like, sometimes I just want the aesthetic. Sometimes I love that spooky New England bullshit. The part of me that worries is that that's not the only thing people are pulling from it. That on some level, they're getting the subtext that, it's sort of laced into the settings and stories that Lovecraft wrote, right? Like, even if if the things that are inspired by Lovecraft are not out there using his incredibly like racist and loaded language, if they're still deploying the tropes and the aesthetics, what other coded messages are in there that are speaking to people that may not immediately be obvious? Right? Like it's like you're pulling like an audio sample and there's a dog whistle in it and you don't know.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I think that's the terrifying thing. Like 100% is that it is working for people. That it is I don't know.
Natalie's having an existential crisis after Rob walked through this.
Yeah, I don't know. That's what scares me. It's super fucking scary. Like, what terrifies me is sitting down with my friends and watching or playing some fucking Cthulhu shit and then being like, haha, this fucking rocks. And then me being the one sitting there, like, I am deeply uncomfortable with who you are now. Like, or that it is me. That it is me sitting there and being like, haha, this rocks, and being like uncomfortable with myself for feeling that way. And that's why I think having the second thought is so important. And I think you're right, Rob, in saying that I don't trust creators to necessarily make that insight every single time these things are presented. Like, I don't know if it's like, I think it is more on the audience or more on the player who is investing themselves in the game. Well, I'd like to hold creators accountable too, but if I'm holding, I'd like to hold players more accountable, because the enjoyment there, it is very easy to take it at face value, and it is but also, like, if you're constantly coming up to a confrontation with something that makes you uncomfortable, if your enjoyment is making you uncomfortable, like, you have to just fucking pull that plug eventually. Like, if your enjoyment of something is making you constantly uncomfortable, making someone you care about constantly uncomfortable, sacrifice that enjoyment. Like, that enjoyment is not so precious and so unique to this thing, in my opinion. Enjoyment can be found in many different places, and the fact that you find it here does not make the loss of it like so significant. Like, that enjoyment will be fulfilled by something else. And so sometimes I think it is okay to let some things we enjoy go, because they are deeply problematic to the point of non-reconciliation.
My wife and I, like, you know, as big horror buffs, like, you encounter shit like this constantly, like, where, like, horror is just ripe, full of bullshit, where you're trying to figure out where you can or can't draw lines, because all sorts of horror is mired in misogyny and racism and also it's like, where do you draw the lines? Or do you just say, oh, well, all horror is problematic, and it's so, like, you can't draw any lines, like, because it's all kind of fucked. And it's like one of the ones that we drew years ago was like, it was viscerally fun to watch revenge flicks, right? Where someone, a thing happens to them, and then they are justified in just enacting pure rage against people who fucking deserve it. And like, there, that taps into like a very visceral part of like your core. And it was enjoyable on some level to watch those films. But the vast majority of those films are premised on like a woman being raped and then enacting that among her male captors or whoever. And none of them, almost none of them, engage in any sort of meaningful like commentary or subversion. It's just, that's the trope. And then she gets to go murder these dudes. And it was just like, I'm fucking done. Like, this is not it's not a genre I need in my life. Whatever the rage part of it, like the visceral nature of like the revenge part is not, it's not worth it. It's not worth it because it's basically every time I boot this up, I just have to sit through and suffer. Like, and that's part, like, that's the construction of the trope, is you suffer through this visually arresting thing so that you can get to the thing that is like, quote unquote, satisfying. It's not. It's just like, I just took it out. Like, now there are occasions like there will be films that have, there's a film from the last 18 months called Revenge that like is explicitly about subverting that. And that movie is like fairly successful at doing that. And like, but I sought that out after reading like commentary about that film. But otherwise, I just subtracted that as a, just don't watch those movies that deal explicitly in the revenge trope, because it just was like, I can't enjoy this anymore. The things I like about it are, I'm not enjoying anymore, because all the other bullshit associated with it just drags the whole thing down for me.
Yeah, that made Girl with the Dragon Tattoo a little complex in many ways, certainly. Rob, I know you had a point.
I'm not sure I did, but I can take one. I think...
like, I saw a hand, I don't know.
On the other hand... No, I don't have a point. I don't have a good one. I'm sorry. I failed.
I'm glad you can admit it, Rob, though, because
sometimes someone I just want to watch my Switch of the Week.
You know?
Look, trying to justify the ethics of watching football is a whole other podcast, Rob.
It is. I could come on and talk about MMA. Little, I'm sure. Just a little. Tiny bit.
I am completely unproblematic, and I live above everyone.
Natalie has viewing parties and tells her friends they are canceled.
Oh! I would not do that. Cancel culture is toxic.
But you know what? Though, I will say this. That is toxic, but I actually do wish it were easier to just fucking blow people up for some of their choices without like, for instance, years and years ago, a friend of mine, a woman of color, like, we were watching West Wing, and she's like, yo, this show seems pretty racist. And I was like, what? No, the show's liberal as hell, man. No, this show's great. And she's like, yeah, the show's pretty good, but every like Black character on the show is like a disaster, and even the way like they're directed just seems like really bad. And I was just like, no, that can't be. Like, no, how? Because this show I love, if it racist, is me racist? Like that? And that was very, and the answer was, the show spoke to prejudices that I didn't realize I had. You know what I mean? Like, that there were blind spots. And so this shit that, like, Aaron Sorkin thought was cool flew right under my radar because, like, I thought it was cool too. And I was not grateful to somebody who knew better pointing out to me that this shit was fucked until a while later when, like, but that stuck in my ear. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't not see it. It was like somebody being like, this is fucked up. And I was like, no, no. And then every scene, I'm like, huh, wait, though. That's a weird way to put that. That character doesn't speak like that. Why was he, why did he deliver that line that way? And, like, once I saw it, I couldn't not see it. And so I think there is value in, I don't know, like, more critical media discussions, right? Like, it's okay to, like, be sitting there on movie night and being like, yeah, the movie's all right, but are you aware, like, of some of the things it's trafficking in? Like, did you, like, let's go back to the, let's roll the tape. Because I think that is a useful exercise, and I think it's a safer place to discuss these issues. Like, because you can see it, it's a referent object. You can see it and discuss it and, like, dissect it, rather than have sort of a sort of vague and abstract discussion, if that makes any sense. So, like, thanks, Call of Cthulhu, for helping us facilitate this discussion.
I mean, it's true. I don't know. I don't know what else. What maybe the Sunken City? We would have gotten around to it anyway. But, like, I'm thankful that I have, like, a better understanding of Lovecraft as a creator, and I wouldn't have, you know, if not having played this, and then, you know, our decision to have a discussion around it. So, like, I'm glad that I know more about him than I did before.
Yes, absolutely. I was going to take a quick dip in the bucket, but, you know, I think we actually, we poured the bucket over. I mean, we went deep into a different bucket today, and I'm very happy.
And we solved ethical media
with our explorations. You know what? All right.
You were no really letters
did.
Needed, folks.
You can now watch
it.
I think we nailed it. We're all agreed here, right?
I don't need letters. Comment bucket. All right, wait. I'll do one really cute, quick one. All right?
Okay.
One cute, quick one from Daniel in L.A. If Waypoint did a group Halloween costume as the characters of The Haunting of Hill House, who would be who? Obviously, Papa Bear would be the dad, but old or young. And we get to decide because Austin's not here.
I think
I haven't watched nearly
a
show
question
to
for,
answer that question.
That's just a Danielle question, I think.
I am definitely...
Oh, you know, Natalie, you watched it too. That's right.
Yeah, I love it. Love it, love it, love it. I am so 100% no. Because I, like, talked to my mom about this, actually, because my mom watched it too. And Nell and I, baby Nell and I, are so similar in what I was like when I was younger. Like, I like, down to, like, what I looked like. I looked, like, a lot, like super pouty lips and super long hair. But also just the way I sort of, like, Nell and Luke... as their kids is very much me and my brother are, like, basically twins. Aww. We're like a year and 361 days apart, we always used to say, because that's how long. But yeah, so
that's exactly how far apart myself and my sister are.
That is very cute.
We're 4 days apart in terms of our birthdays and the two. Yeah, sorry,
we're very powerful. Sorry. It's very powerful connection. So yeah, I decided I would be Nell from the get-go, and I claim her.
I'm going to be Theo. Of course I'm going to be Theo. I could also be Shirley. I could do, like, costume changes between Theo and Shirley. That's, like, I can handle that.
I don't think Austin would be Papa Bear. hold on. I don't think Austin would be the dad.
I mean, he's Papa Bear.
I know, but I don't think he would be the dad, honestly. I don't think so. Because the dad I think he would be... more of
he's
the
a
mom.
Bad dad. He's a bad post.
Yeah, that
post trauma at the
he's
house. He just
dad.
Becomes
post-trauma.
A bad.
And even
like
in,
Austin's closer to the mom than the
yeah,
dad.
That's what I was. Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Is like I think because the mom, like, hears Theo's, like, ability to, like, feel things and stuff like that, and, like, takes it seriously and, like gives her advice on how to move through life with that sort of sensitivity. And so I feel like Austin's more aligned to that aspect of the mom, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Not everyone fits perfectly into characters, but...
I would say Siamese role, like...
Right, this is more of a personality thing.
Well, we don't get... not a lot of options here on the guy front, you know, other than unless you're going to split up Steve between young Steve and old Steve, because no one wants to be fucking old Steve.
Yeah, fuck old Steve.
No!
Like, old Steve is bad. Young Steve seems cool. He seems like he wants to help. Seems
yeah,
like
he
just
wants to
be
a
to
you know,
a
I'll
girl.
Jump on the old Steve grenade. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to jump on it. And I'm going to be like, yo, let me tell you about your experiences you're having and give you a rational explanation for why they're not real. And yeah, what I do is sketchy, and I enjoy writing these books that sort of misrepresent things. And I probably shouldn't be doing it, but I'm going to let myself off the hook because fuck it.
Don't do it, Rob. Have that second thought. Don't just take
old Steve.
Do not
old
give
Steve
in to
can
astonishment.
Definitely separate the art from the artist in Lovecraft, for sure. That's what he does. That's what old Steve does, for sure.
And he takes a big advance.
Oh. Oh boy, Patrick, do you have a?
I don't know. I was going through like I didn't have imaginary friends as a kid, so I was thinking young Luke because he just seems like a nice young boy.
Wait, who is the brother who shows up to rip off Steve?
To rip off Steve?
Luke. In the opening episode. This is the only episode
Luke
I've seen.
To
so
steal?
I'm just like, I could see
drug
myself being
it's
a
really
Luke,
good.
Too. I would definitely steal from Steve, too. That's the thing. I would love to steal from that guy.
Well, yeah, but that's...
I do that. Fuck
there
Steve.
Is ethical consumption under stealing from Steve.
He steals
yes.
people's stories.
You can steal from Steve.
Yeah, fucking
True.
Blood money.
He does.
I don't know. Yeah. I'll go with young Luke.
I think,
even though I can't
think
of a better option.
Patrick, you would be. I think you would be. What's her name? Cheryl. What's her name? Cheryl. What's her name?
Shirley.
Shirley.
Yeah, you would own a funeral home.
Cool.
Because you're spooky like that.
It's a pretty good job.
Because you're into that kind of shit.
True. Yeah. It's an alternate universe where I take my interest in horror and just adapt it literally to my life and career.
I'm a coward,
sure,
too. I would probably definitely, like, flee from the house and leave my wife behind. And then be like, don't worry, kids.
No, he got kicked
out. It was the right
out.
Choice.
Oh, so you would be the dad.
Yeah, maybe.
That's what, yep.
I don't
there
know.
There it is.
We gotta stop this podcast where we learn
it might
more
be the house.
Yeah, we really do.
How they
you could be
the house.
You're the house. You're the house. I decided.
No, Rob would Called be the Rob would be the tall man.
Who's the tall man?
Oh no,
the tall man.
Wait, he doesn't know yet.
He's got a big hat.
Oh yeah, I don't want to spoil it. It's
got
been
a big hat.
Too soon. But like you know,
Polar hat man.
Have you seen the whole show, Natalie?
Yeah.
Oh, but I mean, well, I don't want to say it here. Well, off to you know,
again,
that's
Rob
not all
leave
bad.
So we can talk.
No. We got to leave. We all have to leave. This podcast has to end. We've podcasted for.
We have to leave.
For some of us, we have podcasted for nearly 4 hours today.
Yeah, time to go.
Yep, that's a lot of podcast. All right, on that note, if you have questions, you can send those to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Shoutouts to Too Mellow for the track Bump This off of Trunk Fiction. You can check out his music and musings at Mellow Makes on Twitter and his tracks at 2Mellow Makes.bandcamp.com. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. We're on Twitch at twitch.tv/Waypoint. And you can read everything we do at waypoint.vice.com. Patrick/YoungLuke, where can we find you?
No, I'm old Shirley. I own a funeral home now.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. YoungLuke/old
okay.
Shirley. That's right. Sorry.
Yeah, you can find me at Patrick Colbeck.
Awesome. Young Nell, where can we find you?
Damn, Young Nell. I like that.
Yeah, that's right. Dropping an LP next week.
Young Nell, I'm about to be talking about some monsters. I'm about to be appearing in your apartments, Young Nell. Mixtape's about to be hot.
Good. Good.
You can find me on the internet at Natalie Watson.
Wonderful. This old house. Where can we find you?
At Rob Zachney.
Awesome. And you can find me, and remember, I am Theo, at Danielle R.I. Thank you all so much for bearing with us, listening to our podcast. Appreciate you. And as always, as we close out this weekend, I'd like to say be good and be good out.